All right, we will call the meeting of the Agriculture, Rural Economies, and Veterans Affairs Finance Committee to order. Representative Anderson moves the minutes of February 3rd. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members and folks in the audience, welcome today. Today is U of M Day, and frankly, this will be a prelude to Wednesday also. What we're going to do is hear from the U, whether it takes a half hour, hour, or the whole hour and a half, with questions and answers and discussions with them. And again, I think it's very important that they're here. Because what if you remember what we did, and in the packets, you have House File 797 from last year, or 2 years ago. This was the higher ed bill, omnibus bill, and in there, on page 2 and 3 of the handout, you will see the language that we wrote 2 years ago for the Ag Special. Basically, as you can see, $52, $53 million a year is given to the university to run their college agriculture research and extension service. And as in the past, there's been Ag Special for, I don't know, 100 years. Maybe they can tell us how long. And it's the one way that we offer the university money, and if they choose to accept it, they have to respond to the language we've put with that. Some years there's no language, they just get it. Other years there's extensive language. We don't try, as you can see, dictate dollar amounts, but what we're going to try and glean from them today, and then Wednesday, any producer groups or farm groups or individuals who want to come before the committee next Wednesday and talk about research, what they're doing for research and what they see as research opportunities that may be evolving that they'd like assistance with over at the university, etc. We will then, from that testimony, come back in another week or two and we'll write up this language. We'll send it over to Representative Rukavina's committee, and as usual, he's graciously agreed to pretty much just put it in the bill as we dictate. So this language basically was unchanged when it got to his committee last time. So I think it's an important role for us as people that are taxpayers and finance this this stipend that they get every year, that we should also have some say in what we're looking for. And as you can see, by February 1st, 2009, the Board of Regents must report to the legislative committee. On behalf of the Board of Regents, we have the university folks here today, and so what they're going to do, I hope and assume, is give us some overviews of what they're up to, and then certainly respond on how they address these issues that we wrote 2 years ago. So that's the accountability piece, and we'll do the same thing. We'll write the bill this year. 2 years from now, we want to hear back from them, a report on were they able to accomplish and what are they doing in these areas that we requested them to look at as our land-grant university. Now, you also find your packet, and I know we're going to talk about it, and I saw Dean Levine last night, too. Obviously, this committee is going to have some questions on the corn ethanol study that was in the papers this week. You have a copy of that article from the Tribune. On the third page, if you want to unhook it, it should have been a separate item, but there was a reality check last night. And I contemplated having Will just set it up. We could watch it. It wouldn't take too long. Would have been a fun way to start. But you can read it. You could go online and see it. It was actually an interesting reality check, and we may pose some questions that way, too, to the College of Agriculture here and have some discussion later. But we don't want to get into that right away. We'd rather hear from them first. They'll probably be discussing some of it, but certainly then we'll open it up for questions and discussion from anyone here. If there's anyone in the room that can't be here next Wednesday and would like to say a few words upon listening or anything, please tell the pages as soon as possible. They'll get your name to us, and we're happy to let you come up for a minute or two or five or whatever you want if you think you have something you need to add. So that's to the audience. Reminder, keep the cell phones off, dollar penalty, $5 if you answer it, and there is coffee on up there. This is the Ag Committee, after all, and so help yourself to a cup of coffee, whoever wants it. With that, we'll invite Bev Durgan and Al Levine, our pair of doctors, to come on up, and they got three people. I'm not sure who the third is here. I guess I'd invite you and welcome you and thank you for coming, and ask you to introduce yourselves for the tape and then proceed in any manner you feel fit. We'll pretty much let you do the presentation, and if there are questions along the way, feel free to ask some members. I'm sure they'd be happy to pause and answer if there's a question on a slide or as it comes up. I like to ask questions as we're going too. So, welcome.
Mr. Chair, Bev Durgan, Dean of University of Minnesota Extension and Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station.
Mr. Chair, Trevor Ames, Dean of the College of Veterinary Medicine.
Can you spell your last name?
A-M-E-S.
A-M-E-S, Ames, okay.
Mr. Chair, Al Levine, Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'll start today.
Good.
We just wanted to thank you and the committee for allowing us to be here today to talk about the University of Minnesota's commitment to Minnesota agriculture. We all know that Minnesota agriculture is an important part of Minnesota's economy, with the sales of crops and livestock, with our exports, with our billions of dollars in economic activity, and over 300,000 jobs both in the rural areas and the urban areas of Minnesota. What we'd like to do to talk to you about today is what we feel that University of Minnesota is an important partner with agriculture in the state, that we're an important part of maintaining and growing the agriculture of this state. We'll talk a little bit about what all three colleges are doing, and what our priorities are, what we're up to, as Mr. Chair mentioned, and also talk about how we have invested the funds, the increase in funds that you gave us in 2007. When we were in front of your committee 2 years ago, when we were talking about the 2007 Ag State Special, one of the things that we heard is that the University of Minnesota is not always really good at listening to the needs and the priorities of agriculture. We have, the three deans here have taken that advice to heart, and we've worked very hard in these last 2 years to increase our partnerships and renew our partnerships with agricultural organizations, our state and federal agencies, the legislatures, and the producers here in the state. And we've done that in a number of ways. One, we've initiated an ag working group, which consists of the leaders of the ag commodity groups and other groups here in the state. We meet on a regular basis to talk about priorities and issues within agriculture. We also have added producers and commodity groups to our peer review panel and funding panels for our small grant initiative funding that we receive from the legislature and the rapid response fund. Also, Extension has a committee called the Citizens Advisory Committee. I've added several new members that represent agriculture within the state. This advisory committee we meet on a regular basis and provides advice for Extension and our priorities. The College of Veterinary Medicine and the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences also has advisory committees that they meet with on a regular basis to get input and to make sure that we are working on the priorities for agriculture in Minnesota. What we'd like to do today is to have a three-part presentation. We will talk about, again, what is happening in the three colleges that are responsible for agriculture at the University of Minnesota. My colleague, Dr. Trevor Ames, will start out the presentation, then Dr. Al Levine, and then I will complete the presentation. We're hoping this presentation will be about 30 minutes. And as the chair mentioned, if you have questions as we're going on, just please stop us and we'll try to answer those. With that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Ames.
Thank you, Dean Durgan, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the members of this committee for the opportunity to tell our story. As the slide about today's veterinary illustrates, the role of veterinarians in society is one that bridges animal health and human health, and really one that is continuing to change. We feel that by protecting animal health, veterinarians also protect the state's economy, they ensure a safer food supply, and they enhance public health for Minnesotans. Over the last decade, there's been growing concern over agroterrorism, bioterrorism, foodborne illnesses, disease outbreaks like foot and mouth disease in the United Kingdom, and the spread of infectious agents. And certainly many of these concerns are enhanced by globalization of both trade and travel. Preventing and managing these threats requires a multidisciplinary approach with an emphasis on both livestock systems and food systems. The role of the public health veterinarian is one that has grown greatly in importance over the last decade in response to these issues, especially those involving transmission of disease from animals to man. This is especially true because of the growing state and national shortage of these public health veterinarians working in the state agencies, USDA, the United States Public Health Service, and the Armed Services. It's estimated that some of these services will lose 50% of their veterinarians in the next 5 years due to retirement. Our college has collaborated with the School of Public Health to implement a combined degree program with a Doctor of Veterinary Medicine and a Master's of Public Health. And our program trains more than all of the other colleges in the nation put together. Currently, there are 60 of our students enrolled in this program, and we also train 60 students from other veterinary colleges across the nation. At the college, we focus our research programs to deal with infectious diseases which can cause significant economic loss, as well as those diseases that can cause foodborne illness. We also emphasize a systems approach to deal with livestock health issues, and we use these systems approaches to deal with important diseases like porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, which we deal with both at a farm level, a county level, and even at a regional level. We also have a focus on food systems and how to defend the food system and protect our food supply, and also how to ensure ecosystem health and deal with diseases that can be spread from wildlife to agricultural animals and even to man. We also use animal models of disease to help both human and animal health. And while not directly relating to agriculture, an example of this work is our collaboration with the Cancer Center, where we are evaluating the effectiveness of a brain tumor vaccine in dogs with naturally occurring brain cancer identical to that affecting Senator Kennedy. Bovine tuberculosis doesn't respect state boundaries, it doesn't respect species boundaries. And in the last 15 years, it has become established in a wildlife population of deer, which has never occurred in this country before, and it's created great challenges around control measures. And we found it in both deer and cattle in Minnesota since 2005. The College of Veterinary Medicine, the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences, and the Extension Service have partnered with the state and USDA to deal with this problem. And while researchers are looking for solutions, the Extension Service has been very active in producer education and helping deal with this problem. Our veterinary students have also been involved in the hunter deer harvest to help determine the severity and prevalence of how much there is in our deer population, and have also been part of the cattle surveillance program. The state's veterinary diagnostic lab remains a critical asset for this state. It serves the state by helping producers and veterinarians make sound management decisions based on the millions of tests that it runs every year. The diagnostic lab also does extensive testing to support Minnesota's Departments of Health, Natural Resources, and Agriculture, as well as performing thousands of tests to support the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and its control programs. Testing for diseases like viral hemorrhagic septicemia, a freshwater fish, and chronic wasting disease of wild ruminants helps protect the state's valuable natural resources. Last year, the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab also supported the Minnesota Department of Health in its investigation of the Austin pork plant workers by running tests on samples from 300 employees looking for swine disease agents in these people. Thankfully, none were found. The last biennial request provided some increased funding for the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, which is greatly needed and helped the lab respond to statewide challenges like bovine tuberculosis and avian influenza. The lab also used these resources to put in place some very important quality assurance, quality control processes needed to meet new accreditation standards for the veterinary diagnostic labs of the nation. Well, the veterinary diagnostic lab was viewed very positively for the services it provides and for its quality control and quality assurance. The issue of low state support relative to the peer institutions was identified as a significant issue and resulted in only 1 year of accreditation as opposed to the usual 5 years of accreditation. This places Minnesota's large animal export industry at risk if this accreditation is lost. The issue, combined with the need for additional funding to ensure adequate disease testing within the state, prompted Vice President Frank Thayer and I to write to your committee to ask for increased support. While the worsening economy and the declining budgets have greatly affected the university funding, the university now no longer feels that this is the best approach to funding, but the need remains. The state is also seeking federal support on two fronts. One is for expanded bovine tuberculosis research in conjunction with Michigan State University. Michigan also has bovine tuberculosis and probably a much more severe problem than Minnesota. Michigan State University has had a USDA special grant dealing with bovine tuberculosis for the last 5 years, and they've come to the University of Minnesota, asked us to partner with them to seek increased joint funding for both universities. Within the new Farm Bill, there is very explicit language that describes the need for centers of excellence in training the nation's veterinary students in selected areas of animal practice. The College of Veterinary Medicine has formed a public-private partnership with David Family Dairy and will open an education facility on a new dairy in New Sweden, Minnesota in March. This facility receives significant contributions from industry partners including lending institutions, nutritional companies, and pharmaceutical companies. This funding allowed us to build facilities that are of the size and quality that we feel make us very competitive for being considered as a national center for excellence in training veterinary students. Well, we recognize that states like California and San Diego may be the place for naval bases, and Arizona may be the place for an astronomy facility. We think that Minnesota should be the national facility for training dairy veterinarians. We've also developed a number of initiatives to help place more veterinarians in rural communities. One of these is an early admission, early decision program called VetFast, or Veterinary Food Animal Scholars Track. We've done this in partnership with the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences. Currently, in the sophomore and junior year of animal science, and in all years of our curriculum, we have 10 to 15 students enrolled through this program, and we have a goal of having 20 students a year graduate from this program. The first two students graduated last spring. They both went into food animal practice in Minnesota.
Dr. Ames, can you give me an idea on the geographic, if there is, a large animal veterinarians?
Yes.
You're alluding to that as a shortage. I've heard that in national meetings also that I attend, and some of us attend with agriculture. However, in my area, we have enough large animal folks. And do you have a map, or can you give us an idea where in Minnesota the shortages are, if anywhere, or how we're keeping up locally on? I know there's some areas that may be, but I'm not sure which.
The American Veterinary Medical Association on their website actually has posted maps that show the relative density of food animal veterinarians versus food animals. There's many counties in Minnesota that have over 25,000 head of livestock with no food animal veterinarians in those areas.
So we
certainly
have
the larger
shortages.
I'm sorry.
We have spot shortages in Minnesota.
Yeah. I would say significant shortages. Certainly the larger urban centers have sort of the larger regional practices, but there are many areas of the state where that shortage exists.
Yeah, I'd be curious from you, just on a follow-up, not here, but if you could give us numbers of shortage. I mean, how many vets do we need to be putting out of your, out of the U of M or other places or recruiting into the state? How many a year are we short? And it's something we may address in the future, too, with different lunch.
We did do a manpower study a couple of years ago within the veterinary college, and we felt that the numbers that we were graduating in the late 90s, where we were graduating 10 to 15 dairy vets, 3 to 5 swine vets, 1 to 2 poultry vets a year, was meeting the needs. So we feel that through this VetPass program, we hit our target of 20 students a year, that we will be meeting those needs.
And conversely, we're fine with small animal practices?
We are doing very well with graduating an adequate number of small animal practices. There are also Caribbean veterinary schools, and there's a new private veterinary school in Pomona, California, that are essentially, you know, graduating small animal veterinarians. As a land-grant university, we feel it's our responsibility to also meet the needs of agriculture and public health within the state.
Okay.
We've also changed our admission program, and so we don't just focus purely on GPA. We also focus on behavioral traits that predict success in the profession. So we used a very in-depth, over 1 hour interview with over 300 candidates. We get over 1,200 applicants a year. We interviewed 300 of them. And so we have students with 4.0 GPAs that do not get accepted into veterinary school if they don't have the behavioral traits we're looking for. We also emphasize leadership and professional development heavily throughout our curriculum. We have a goal to train the leaders of tomorrow to go out into the rural communities of the state. We also focus on experiential education to a greater degree than other veterinary schools, and we get our students hands-on experience from the start of their freshman year. I've worked and talked to a number of you about a loan forgiveness program, and this year Senator Dill is authoring a loan forgiveness program for veterinary students going into rural areas, underserved areas, that are working on food animals. This is a loan forgiveness program that would pay back loans over a five-year period in practice. This five-year period is based on national studies that have shown if professionals, veterinarians, go into a rural community, stay in that rural community for more than 5 years, their chances of remaining in that community are significantly higher, and they have the highest job satisfaction in the profession. So thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to tell you about what's going on at the veterinary school. And I think now I will turn it over to Dean Levine for his presentation.
Very good.
I have to step right in.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think you can see that we're starting to work together in a major way towards doing things around production agriculture. You heard about the VetPass program. I will say that the greatest number of undergraduate students we have in the college right now are in animal science. A lot of them are pre-vets, so we work handily together on these things. Currently, I just put up some numbers for those who are interested in the number of undergraduates. We have around 1,760 undergraduates. We have a host of majors, 14 majors, 22 minors. We have 700 graduate students and 13 graduate programs. Five of those graduate programs are interdisciplinary across the university, so we're very diverse.
Do you know, Dr. Levine, what percentage of those undergrads are Minnesota students?
We have around, I think it's around 40 to 50%. I didn't bring the numbers, but it's been decreasing over the, if you look since 78 to some degree, because we've recruited outside as well. We have a fair number from Wisconsin.
Okay.
As well. The undergraduate enrollment figures here, just to show you the trend from 1990 through today, we've grown, obviously, since 1990 in a fairly major way. In the past few years, we fluctuated right around the mid-1700s. Point. And we continue to have a lot of people, a lot of students applying. We have a large contingent of students applying this year as well. It's across many disciplines in addition to just the production ag areas. Our students compete nationally. We have livestock judging teams. We have food product development teams. The food product development team this year won a prize nationally. The dairy judging team, the turf club. We have ag ed professional societies, and we have four of the six state officers in FFA are CFAN students. And also this year, the homecoming queen was Megan Hines from our college, and Princess Kay is here today, Christine Luffman. The last 2 years we've had Princess K from our college. So our students are doing very well. They're seen as part of that agricultural network across the country. We're really in there trying to educate the next generation of agricultural leaders. And I'm always surprised that students don't wind up in the agricultural sciences, because if you can see here from the numbers of students that were surveyed in 2007, 94% of our students found a job within 6 months of graduating. My son's a violinist. It will take him 6 years or more. 46% were offered jobs prior to graduation. 61% of the jobs related to their majors, and it's a decent salary to come right out of college with. So it's clear that agricultural sciences is a good area for students to go into. To give you an idea of the kind of investments, our recent investments, and this is to address in part the 2007 biennial funding that we received, we have during this period of time tried to relocate our portfolio towards agriculture, production agriculture in a fairly major way. I can tell you I've appointed now 5 heads of departments since I've been in over the last few years. All of them work in the area of production agriculture and cropping systems. All of them. Brian Bohr in animal science, Gary Renixius in food science, who works with the food industry in a major way, Nancy Elke, who works with rye seed, Professor Lynn, Jim Lynn in dairy, and recently Emily Hoover, who works in terms of development of fruits and vegetable crops. In the area of cropping systems, livestock, renewable energy, food safety, beef production, organic areas, invasive species, and forest entomology, we have either hired folks in these areas or have plans to. Of course, with the current set of cuts, we're in a hiring pause at the university, we're examining our portfolio very carefully before we move forward. But we haven't ceased working in this area if we know how important it is. We've hired people in each of these areas. We have 2 positions now from the past funding that were directed towards that are being interviewed currently. It took some time to accumulate some funds. The startup packages for a faculty member in the area of biofuels and renewable energy are fairly sizable because of equipment needs. But we put aside $250,000 per professor, and we're interviewing now in the area of biocatalysis and bioprocessing engineering. There are over 50 faculty that work in the area of biofuels research, as you know. We have a whole host of people in that area, and we have a great deal of food safety issues that we collaborate with the vet school as well, and with the School of Public Health. So there's a diverse portfolio, and we made certain to continue in that area. Also, we wanted to mention that our scientists in our college are providing different plant varieties to the folks in Minnesota, which help a great deal. Tom Wheat, named after Tom Anderson from Barnesville, who was with the wheat growers for many, many years. We have a variety that is moderately resistant to UG99. Most of you in here are probably aware that UG99 is a wheat stem rust out of Uganda. It hasn't reached here yet, but because we have BSL3 and BSL2 facilities, we can look at these types of issues in greater detail than in other places. We have a relationship with the university in Tel Aviv, taking a look at wild wheat and taking a look for resistant genes in there to address this issue. We have also RB07 wheat, a high yield in protein, Rasmussen barley, which is a high malt extract and yield. And also, as you know, everybody knows the Honeycrisp apple. It takes 20 years or so to develop those apples, and the funds that are the royalties from that then are provided towards the next generation of apples that are being developed. And most of you in here know Jim Luby, who's been working in this area for a long time. In the area of energy, we have a great deal of variety in terms of what we do. We're interested, as you know, in ethanol and biodiesel byproducts. And you see some pictures here of some DDGs with Jerry Kirsten on the right, who's an expert in this area. We work in the area of biomass systems, the economics associated with this, building conservation, discussing things such as carbon credits and wind systems. Up in Morris, there's a windmill. You all know about the wind turbine that's up there. We're in the process of working towards taking that wind turbine and using the energy from that to make anhydrous ammonia fertilizer. A dream of mine would be to see a microtized version of that on every farm, where you could provide the anhydrous ammonia through wind power in a small way and distribute it. And so we're working towards that as well as an area. Another big focus, we're one of the only laboratories in the five-state area. We are the only laboratory that has a bee laboratory. In fact, we're now fundraising to develop an extended bee laboratory. Colony collapse is something that's been in the news a great deal. We know that a third of our food depends on pollinating honeybees, and we've put some funding into the area of propolis research. I don't know if you're familiar with propolis, but it's a resin. The bees pick it up on their feet when they go to a tree, bring it back to the hive, help make the hive from that resin. It's called propolis. It has antimicrobial properties associated with it. It keeps the hive microbial, not free, but protected against microbes. We think it may be involved in some way in colony collapse. And also, in Eastern Europe, a lot of people, if you go into a health food store, ingest propolis because of its potential qualities. It actually has anti-HIV qualities. It's been shown by Dr. Peterson at the University of Minnesota. We're also protecting the state through our insect quarantine facility and our plant pathogen quarantine facility. I mentioned that when I was mentioning UG99. If you haven't been over to campus to see those facilities, come over sometime. I know the Senate committee visited recently. It's a wonderful place. You can't go inside of the BSL-3 for the exact reason. It's a very highly protected, but we're one of the only places that has it with greenhouses right next door where you can grow the pathogen, infect the plants, and study what happens. And the 2 is used around, the BSL-2, around insect quarantine facilities. So those are my comments at this point, and thank you very much, Chair and committee members.
Representative Falk. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question. You didn't break out Minnesota Crop Improvement Association. Is that funded through your department at all, or is that separate? Or
it's a collaboration. Dr. Levine?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
Well,
yep,
what's the collaboration?
Dr. Levine, please expand on that answer.
Yeah.
Or Dr.
Durgan can expand.
Chair, Representative, Minnesota Crop Improvement Association is a private organization that works cooperatively with the Minnesota Agricultural Experiment Station, so MCIA and Experiment Station. MCIA, we have a contract with MCIA to market and to work directly with our breeders to release all of our agronomic crops. So MCIA is funded privately, but they're funded primarily through many of their programs with releasing University of Minnesota crop varieties. So they have been heavily involved in our release of palm wheat, in our barley varieties, our oat varieties.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Junkie. And for the testifiers, first of all, welcome to the committee. It was a pleasure working with you guys last year, or 2 years ago, when we put together the Ag Special, and there were many members around the committee table here that helped put together the Ag Special that I carried from the committee to higher education and on. And we increased funding for the university for their Ag Special, and then we also put in a number of issues that we wanted you to address, and I see you're starting to address those in the PowerPoint, so that's good. But my question, just to go back to the issue of our byproducts from the biofuels production. Can you tell me, you said that you were working on, just somebody was working on this and you're doing certain things. Can you tell me, was that being done before? Even with the increase of funding, you're essentially maintaining what you did before, or did you actually put some emphasis and some additional resources into that area that we specified in the legislation? So if you can, as you're going along and you're addressing these issues that you know we had in the Ag Special, if you can tell us what you actually did above and beyond what you were doing before since you got the additional appropriation, I'd appreciate that.
And the reason Representative Welty has asked that is we hope, I think he's the only one on, correct me if I'm, anyone else on Rukavina's committee besides Welty? So what we're going to do, hopefully, is count on Representative Welty to be our point person again. And when he carries our new bill over there, he needs to talk to the committee about what was done with the additional funding and why it was necessary and the good things, hopefully, that are happening with it. So I know he's asking for ammunition to carry that bill over and defend it once he gets over in that hostile
committee of Rooka Venus. So if you could respond to Representative Welty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty. We were doing work, Terry Sherson was working in that area, and it's expanded, but the focus has been on those new two hires in terms of biofuels specifically, to get people in the area of biocatalysis and bioproduct conversion to really deal a lot with also with the lignocellular issues that are around that. So we put funding into that and saved appropriation dollars towards the startup packages for those positions.
So two new positions on that.
Right.
Okay. I believe you're up, Dr. Durbin. Here they go with the musical chairs again.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You've heard from my colleagues the importance of research and extension in their colleges, and I just would like to conclude today with some additional information on what we're doing at the University of Minnesota Extension, and I'll also address some of the issues that Representative Welty has talked about us, of how we've used the increase in the state special. Dean Levine talked about the BL2 facility. The BL2 facility is a facility that has allowed us to conduct the research and education on the devastating insect soybean aphid. When soybean aphid was first discovered in Minnesota, the next year it cost over $200 million in yield losses because of this insect. By using the BL2 facility and then our faculty using that research to develop an IPM model, an integrated pest management model, to manage this insect, that we have been able to decrease the yield losses with soybean aphid and decrease the amount of insecticide used in this crop. A study that was conducted in cooperation with University of Minnesota and Michigan State has determined that the investment in this research will pay off in generating an additional $1.3 billion in soybean yields and decreased pesticide use in the North Central region over the next 15 years. So a very good use of the investment of the dollars in this particular insect. We know that the University of Minnesota Extension has a long history of providing financial expertise to the ag industry, and we currently are continuing to be a leader in providing bankers and growers with information on their farming enterprise. Currently, over 200 Minnesota banks, 700 producers, the Minsky system, use our FinPAC program to determine the financial health of their agricultural enterprise. And FinPAC is the standard in the industry nationwide for analyzing business enterprises. We also currently have over 5,000 Minnesota producers that have improved their marketing skills with Winning the Game. And that is a very important, that is, again, a cooperation, a project with bankers, cooperatives, and crop insurance agencies. And this is a very important program in that it helps our growers to decrease their financial risk, especially with the fluctuating commodity prices that we have right now. And one issue that I just wanted to bring forward to the committee, and I think I'm sure many of you are aware of that, so our ag community, our ag economy has been strong in the previous years, that our ag producers are starting to feel the pain of our economic crisis. And the number of our mediation cases in our farmer lender mediation program has increased 13% over the last 6 years, and we have some indication that those mediation cases are going to be significantly increased this next year. So we have a situation where the fluctuating commodity prices, the input prices, is going to put some stress on our ag community, and we'll continue to support that farmer lender mediation program, but also to work very hard in helping our growers make decisions before they have to get into the mediation program. So to talk a little bit about some of the work that we're doing with the dairy industry, we mentioned with VetMed that they want to develop a nationwide center for the training of the dairy vets in the nation. We also are working with our dairy producers to increase the lifespan of dairy cows in the state, increase their comfort, and also to increase the productivity of dairy producers, but we're doing this by taking the research that's been developed and working directly on farm with our producers. One of the issues that was mentioned in the Ag State Special was some emphasis on organic and sustainable agriculture. Organic is the fastest growing food segment in the U.S. right now, and there are the producers and also consumers of organic food are asking questions about how to produce it and where to find it. So currently we are taking a number of steps and using the Ag State Special money to convert the dairy at the West Central Research and Outreach Center at Morris to an organic dairy. But it's not just an organic dairy. It's going to be unique in the nation in that it will have organic production right next to conventional production. So this will give the University of Minnesota a way to compare organic dairy production directly in comparison to a conventional dairy, which, again, is those are some of the questions that we're seeing producing side by side. We also, as you know, that we also have University of Minnesota has the largest number of certified crop acres, certified organic crop acres of any land grant university at our Southwest Research and Outreach Center at Lamberton, and we have put additional resources into that in from the Ag State Special into managing those acres at Lamberton, and we are also in the process of hiring a faculty member for that area in organic agriculture at Lamberton. Also, just wanted to mention that in cooperation with Minnesota Crop Improvement Association, our soybean breeding project has been releasing certified organic soybean varieties that can be used in the organic market. We're one of the few land-grant universities that continue to produce non-GMO soybeans for the organic market. And finally, that we continue to support the Minnesota Institute of Sustainable Agriculture. We have, with the Ag State Special money, have hired a alternative livestock extension educator that works with MISA and other educators in the alternative livestock and organic area. Dr. Ames mentioned food safety, and as you know, food safety is an issue that we're seeing in the paper almost on a daily basis. And the University of Minnesota has a very strong commitment to food safety. You just look nationwide, and I think these numbers will go up if we count the peanut butter scare that we are having right now, that we have, you know, millions of cases of foodborne illnesses in the U.S. on a yearly basis. We have a team of scientists with CFANS and VetMed working on preventing E. coli in food. We also have our scientists and researchers looking at ways to prevent and to detect foodborne diseases. We have extension educational program to train food workers throughout Minnesota. Minnesota does have is mandated to have a trained food worker in each one of their food handling facilities throughout the state. The University of Minnesota Extension offers courses both online and in person, also in Spanish and in Somali for food workers throughout the state. And also we work with the National Center for Food Protection and Defense and a leading center in the nation for looking at detecting and preventing foodborne illnesses. Also, I just want to mention our commitment to building future leaders for now and in the future, and our commitment from Extension and our leadership programs. We work cooperatively with Southwest State University in Marshall on our MARL program, building agriculture and rural leaders, our leading emerging leaders program in the Red River Valley. We have a program with the Soil Water Conservation District, our Horizon program. And, of course, we know that we cannot just think about leaders as they're adults. We have to think about building leaders as they're youth, and our 4-H and youth development programs continue to be strong throughout the state of Minnesota. In fact, in the last 2 years, we've had an increase of over 10% of our 4-H members in clubs in Minnesota. So it's a strong program and our continued commitment. We also know that there is a concern about where our next generation of scientists are coming from. We hear that from our producers, and we also hear that concern as we're looking for faculty to hire. So we took $1 million of the Ag State Special, the $1 million in non-recurring money, and put that into graduate assistantships. We currently have 14 graduate assistantships working with our top faculty in the three colleges in areas of renewable energy, livestock and crop production, alternative organic agriculture, and extending the Minnesota growing season using the high tunnel technology that was developed in our horticulture department. This increase in graduate student assistantships is going to have a great impact in the amount of research and extension that we conduct at the University of Minnesota, but also I think is an excellent way for us to continue to build agricultural professionals in the state. It will have a great impact on what we're going to do over the next 2 years. Finally, as Dean Levine mentioned, we have been hiring faculty in areas that were listed with the Ag State Special and areas of priority. We have hired a extension educator in renewable energy. He's in the economics department and has just started, and I think will be a great addition to looking at the economics of renewable energy. We've hired faculty in agronomic crops. One is Jeff Coulter, who is in corn production, livestock production, organic and alternative agriculture, that we're looking at hiring a, we're in the process of hiring an extension educator and a faculty member in those areas. Finally, I just did want to mention, though this was not an increase in the Ag State Special last year, that we do have the Agricultural Rapid Response Fund. And it is a fund that we have that we are able to put funding towards issues that are a critical issue in agriculture. And as I mentioned, that we have a review panel of faculty and ag leaders to decide where we should put this funding. This group just met yesterday to develop, to decide where we're going to put the funding to the next biennium. But the last biennium, we were able to use this money for funding for bovine TB research, biofuel byproducts, the DDGSs, swine and turkey diseases, dairy housing, and improving crop production. And again, we want to thank the legislature and also thank your committee for that recurring funding in our Ag State Special. It's called the Rapid Agricultural Response Fund. It has had a great impact in us responding to serious issues facing agriculture, such as soybean aphid that we've used this money for in the past. Finally, in conclusion, we again want to thank the chair and the committee for having us here today, and we also want to emphasize that the University of Minnesota is a statewide organization. We have a presence throughout the state. We live in the communities, and we work closely with the ag organizations, the federal, state, county agencies, legislatures, and the producers out there to really serve agriculture throughout the state and not just in the Twin Cities metro area. So with that, that does conclude our presentation, and we'd be happy to give more specifics or answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I have a couple questions first, and then I'm sure we have others. Can you comment, please comment on, and you commented to me and we've met on it and we continue to meet, on the situation of the poultry research facility, which was addressed in here at Umore Park. Again, we're still the number one poultry producing state, and Sandy Lake County is the number four county in the United States. I just have to mention that all the time, Nate.
Well,
I know you got Worthington, but you don't hold a handle to Sandy Lake County. Oh, you do? Oh, turkey days. All right. Can you talk to us a little bit about what's going on with that and relocating or maintaining that once Umore Park becomes inactive for the U down there?
Chair, we've been meeting and doing preliminary drawings and planning with Miller and Dunwoody on new facilities. We're taking a close look. We've just met recently. The three of us were presented the plan. Greg Cuomo is overseeing a lot of these plans in terms of taking a look at the movements of the material of the turkeys. And at the current time, we're really at the state of investigating the cost and the distribution of these birds. It won't. It turns out that in Umore Park, we will not need to move the turkey facilities for 5 years or so, 5 to 10 years, actually.
So the area of that park isn't being redeveloped at this point?
Not yet.
Okay. My second question, can you specifically comment on the harvesting and transporting of biomass plant material that was in here? That's always a big deal. How are we going to densify or transport, or what are we doing to look at those types of systems?
Mr. Chair, I can say that our DBE, our Department of Bioproducts and Biosystems Engineering, has folks that are particularly looking at the concentration and densification of that material in order to be able to move it. So Roger Ruin and others have been looking specifically at that. I don't know all of the studies that are going on currently.
Are you participating, Dr. Levine, in any of the corn cob harvest and the new equipment coming and or the fertility aspect of it for removal of the cobs and what that means for soil fertility, soil tilth, and organic matter, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the details at that level.
All right, if you can give me that information, that's one I want to know about, because that is something that's coming rapidly, and I want to understand if we're involved with that. And
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
If I could, that our extension soil scientists are working closely with when you develop the crop models of how much silver you could take off of those fields for biomass and maintain nutritional balance and what the balance is. So our soil scientists extension faculty are working closely with trying to develop those crop budgets.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. From research I've seen, taking the corn cobs off the field, there's no nutritional value to corn, the corn cobs, I should say. So that's a lot better than taking the entire stock. But the cobs themselves do not yield any nutritional value to the soil. Just a question I have for Dr. Durbin. It's obvious the university and agriculture have a lot in common. They work with each other very well. But when some of these negative ethanol comments and articles come out of the university, I think farmers wonder if in fact it's friend or foe. Could you comment on the university's position on studies such as that are negative to aspects of agriculture?
Dr. Durbin.
Representative. Part of what happens in university and in scientific discovery is that you tend to get differences of opinion on almost anything. We have, as Dr. Levine mentioned, and I will turn it over to him in a minute, over 50 faculty working in the area of biofuels, bioenergy. And the studies that come out don't always agree with one another, but it's important to be able to publish those and have the scientific dialogue. A recent article that just came out of the University of Nebraska looking at corn ethanol and the economics of that is also a study with the University of Minnesota is involved with the North Central Bioenergy Consortium that we provided funding on. And some of the results of that paper are the same as the one that just was out, and some of them are different. And that's what happens when you're looking at a study that you see lots of sometimes differing views, but we continue to look at those, and it's important to have that dialogue. And we'll turn it over now to Dr. Levine to talk a little bit more specifically about the last paper if you have those questions.
And before you do, I'm going to comment too, just for the heck of it. As you knew I would, and so if you don't mind, Representative Anderson, to add to what you said, you know, I can tell you I believe that this committee is going to have a real interest in understanding how the College of Food and Agriculture over there can better participate in doing their own work in these areas without any predetermined end, but again, doing our own economic studies with your new hire. You hired an economics for renewable energy. And what does renewable fuels mean to rural Minnesota and the state as a whole? To look at BTU energy balance here in the state, where we have biodiesel mandates firing our equipment in the summer, and we have ethanol plants that are now coming on board with gasification systems and other things, unique probably to Minnesota plants as opposed to some of the, and again, I have not looked at the study that came out from the university in detail other than the article, which I think Representative Magnus has a copy of it here, but we can certainly get copies of people that want it. And numerous other things. I suspect next week we'll hear from the corn growers and the ethanol plants on what they would like to see coming out of our own college. And why I respect stuff coming out of Purdue or Nebraska or Argonne University or all the other places. Unfortunately, the only thing coming out of our land-grant university recently that's caught the eye and attention are these types of what I would call negative reports on ethanol. And we certainly do know there's two sides to these stories. We know that these studies, and I don't know how we review these internally, how the university does that. I think that's something we want to explore. Again, if you read the reality check, you know, they reported what the study said, but at the end, you know, when they were reporting the pricing on it, for those that didn't see it or haven't read it yet, if you take the subsidies away from ethanol, the current value is 223. If you take the subsidies away from unleaded fuel, the price would be $5.85 today. Now, I haven't gotten his resource on that yet. I actually wrote Kessler this morning and asked him to send me the citations for that and where it came from. But, I mean, if those types of things, if we're even peer-reviewing internally at the U, that we should be calling and say, you're right, it isn't the whole story. And what are we doing to do that? You know, and this will be my opinion, but I think it's pretty factually based. We've seen over the last few years, the oil companies and the National Grocers Association have done a very good job of partnering, of setting up nonprofits or other groups out there to provide funding to universities and others around. And frankly, bringing in a lot of select environmental groups into their fold, which tends to somehow lend some credibility, and they have been very good at what they're doing. We in agriculture, unfortunately, are kind of Scandinavian. You know, we go about our business, we know what we're doing is right, we know it makes sense, we know it leads to other things. Our plants today will be the cellulosic plants of tomorrow. We never talk about that. We know there's a good American lung, Minnesota lung will come in and talk about the environmental aspects of it. We know it's all there, but we're not good at tooting our own horn. And I don't think we're good at bringing research out of our College of Agriculture, our land-grant university, that would respond to some of the distinct Minnesota biofuels issues that are out there. And again, as we go forward, members, I would suspect we want to understand how we can do a better job at that type of research, etc. So, just a short comment to you, Dr. Levine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. This, we could go on for days discussing how university research is conducted and how it is reviewed and how it's peer-reviewed. In reality, there's not an internal peer-review system because of the fact that the faculty, they pass on their papers to others who are expert in the field. But we don't control the research at that level. It goes out to the professional groups. This particular paper was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the premier journal for the National Academy of Science. The ones that you have seen and get a lot of publicity were published in those high-impact journals, Science or PNAS. We have lots of other research that don't hit the headlines because of the fact that they're not in that high, visible type of journal. Plus, the media is less interested without some kind of a story of conflict involved in it to some degree. So it's interpreted in a different fashion as well. I would say in that particular study, it was reviewed by their peers. It's a I don't know what the numbers are, but it's probably under 1% of the papers that are submitted get accepted into that journal, so it's highly reviewed. Therefore, their professionals in that area have a great deal of respect for the data that came out of that paper. I immediately called out Jason Hill, who was the first author, when the Nebraska paper was handed to me, and asked him about that, and his response was, well, they didn't include greenhouse gases in their calculations. And the reality check tells us that, well, the Hill paper probably didn't include the subsidies in there. This is the way research is always discussed. We've been through this for generations and generations, having spent a good deal of time around the nutrition area. If you all remember, there was a lot of conflict about whether we should be eating saturated fats and meat or we should be eating eggs every day. People were upset with those data. They've taken 30, 40 years of research, and they've come to some kind of conclusion around it. We're still asking the question. So my point is, this is not, these people don't go into this mean-spirited in order to cause the industry grief. They go in to take a look at the comparison between these different types of methods of looking at biofuels. This is their estimate of the results. Remember, this is economics. We use the word like diapers. It depends. These are models. This wasn't an experiment that was done to see whether or not you got more particulate matter or less. It's taken from the literature. So it's a different kind of a paper. But the results are stated and overstated in different ways that cause some grief for us in the agricultural industry.
Kate, questions, comments on anything? You got a question?
Yes,
Representative Chairman Otremba.
Thank you. Dr. Ames, I'm just putting this on for the record because I know there are a lot of large animal vets that would like to retire. And in those cases, a lot of them, it's hard to even get kids to go and do that. And so for the record, I know that there's a lot of need for the large animal vets.
Maybe you can comment. Do you have a partnering? I know the a good model example is the dental school now, and I know about it because we just built a facility in our Rice Hospital in Wilmer. There's a free clinic there now that's staffed rotationally by dental students from the Minneapolis campus. They come out, they get to work on a month for a month on all different kinds of folks that come through that clinic at the hospital, but they also then go and spend some time with a rural dentist and understand that they can make money out there, that it's a pretty good place to live, and that there might be advantages to practicing in rural Minnesota. Do you have those type of rotations going on with your vet students?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trumba, our senior year, actually the last 60 weeks that the students are in their four-year program is made up of what we call two-week experiences or rotations. And so in those rotations, many of those are based within the veterinary college, but many of those are also based in rural communities, and a percentage of those are what we call externships or preceptorships. So up to 10 weeks, the students can be in private practices working side-by-side with veterinarians, sort of gaining an appreciation of the practice. We haven't taken it to the level of maybe the way the dental school has of having students go into rural areas every student. We've made it more about the students that are interested in food animals and try to attract those students so then they would be the ones that would be more likely to go into rural communities. There are some differences in the profession. And I'm very good friends with the Dean of Dentistry, and I do remind him that we work on more than one species and more than one organ system. So we do have a lot of students that go into a whole diverse area. And so we're really looking at attracting students from rural communities. And the Rural Physicians Program in Duluth has looked at that inside and out, and the number one predictor of if you will go into a rural community is if you are from a rural community. And so if we can attract these students to the Vet Fast program, give them a career pipeline where they can see how they would start in agriculture, then transfer into vet med, get both degrees in 7 years, then go into a rural community and have some loan forgiveness, then I think that those are the students that will stay and be successful in those communities and be happy in those communities. One thing I didn't mention is that a lot of our retiring veterinarians, the one area that has really attracted their philanthropic giving is scholarships to this VetFast program. And the university currently has a matching program for undergraduate scholarships so that if a rural veterinarian gives us $25,000, the university matches that. So in the last year alone, we've actually come up with four new scholarships for Vet Fast students. So we are, you know, there are some even philanthropic alternatives to this aside from the loan forgiveness.
Okay, Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to pass along just some comments from vegetable producers in my area. I represent Lakeside Foods, which has one location in Plainview, Minnesota, and they have other locations in the state. And in recent discussions with them, they brought up the fact that they really appreciated the research that was done at the University of Minnesota related to sweet corn, pea, and even green bean production, looking at herbicides, pesticides, fertilizer research, and variety research. They have noticed, though, in recent years that there seems to be less emphasis on vegetable research. And so I wanted to pass that along to you as a comment of, one, that the research that you do is definitely acknowledged in greater Minnesota, and two, they do realize when it looks as though or appears as though there is a the emphasis in a certain area. And so I just want you to pass that along or comment on that particular issue. And just so you know, Minnesota is one of the top states as far as sweet corn production, pea production, and vegetable production. And I'm sure you already know that.
Anyone? Yeah, Dr. Levine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty. I just wanted to comment that with the Farm Bill and with the specialty crop granting in the area of fruits and vegetables, more and more of our faculty are getting interested in those applications, the Horticultural Sciences Department particularly, and I'm certain that you'll see an increase, you know, where there's opportunity, I think we'll find some increase in people working in that area.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and, you know, we are number one in turkeys, and you should be very proud of that. However, if you break it down and add up the receipts and the economic contributors, swine is number one, my friend. So, and Representative Otremba, I know you talk a lot about talk about women in agriculture and stuff like that, and I went and had the opportunity to speak at the pre-vet club, and there were 70 students there, and only two were male. You know, so that was very interesting. It's very interesting. My question has to do with ag educators. And you take a look at the number of ag educators that we have or don't have across the state. And so can you just comment a little bit on the enrollment of people that are interested in ag education and our commitment, the university's commitment to that area, please?
Chair, Representative Hamill. We have around 60, between 60 and 70 students that are dedicated towards agricultural education. We were in partnership with the College of Education and Human Development in terms of this program. We're in the process of transitioning that program so it's holistically in our college. It will be in the Department of Applied Economics. We will increase, we will have faculty dedicated to ag education and leadership. We've had talks with Extension as well about bringing in leaders from the Extension team to start teaching or giving instruction to these students as well as far as leadership goals. So we're pretty excited. And also we know that the ag educators out in the community have been talking about the fact that we need more economics in our coursework too, and it's an important part of this. So having it in the agricultural economics, in the applied economics department is really important to make this more a stronger program. So we're very hopeful because this has dropped down to, we had, at the end of the day, we had one faculty member who was dedicated toward that. And so we just interviewed for another faculty member. The faculty member that's in the College of Education and Human Development, if everything goes right and gets tenure, will move over to our college and we'll develop the leadership development around it as well.
Yep, Representative Hamilton.
I work directly in the swine industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I work directly in the swine industry, and one of the things that we're looking for is leaders in the area in production. And so we need a commitment from your university and others to develop those leaders as well. So I don't know if you'd like to comment on that or not, but just a comment that I'd like to make.
Go ahead. Dr. Kirk.
Representative Hamilton. We're committed to that, too. We think that is one of the main focus that the university can do is building the human capital in Minnesota. So, our programs in 4-H, our adult leadership programs, and the conversations that Dr. Levine and I are having in the head of a leadership cohort and what that looks like and what a leader is. So we're committed to that, and we agree with you that is needs to be a very high priority for the University of Minnesota.
We visited that Ag Charter School, Representative Otremba, last year or 2 years ago. Are you interfacing with those students now as they're coming through? I think there should be some graduate classes pretty quick out of there. How are we interfacing to get those people into our university for ag educators or, you know, swine nutritionists or others?
Mr. Chair, some of our faculty have been working closely with a group, particularly around the food science area. I know they've been visiting and going back and forth. I don't know the numbers that have transitioned over. I can't address that, but I can certainly find that out.
All right. Yeah, we'd be interested in knowing how that interface is. Representative Farkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question would be to Dean Durgan. Could you talk a little more about Extension, in particular where Extension is headed, and the relationship of the Extension program to the county governments in the state of Minnesota?
Chair.
Durgan.
Representative. Extension has in the past and currently in the future is a partnership with local government counties, with the state, and with federal government. So looking with our county partners right now that we have an extension presence in every county. Every county provides funding for a local extension program as well as our regional and state program. We work with the counties now through a memorandum of understanding. The counties determine at what level that they want to have extension and what kind of staffing that they would like in every county. Every county has committed to our 4-H and our youth development program, so we have that presence. Our next presence on the local level is in agriculture, and we have over 50 faculty located in our throughout the state working in agriculture, and we also have a number in the master gardeners. So we are committed to working with our county partners. Our county partners are also, with talking to them, are very happy with our local presence and the interaction with our regional educators in our state. I do have to tell you that we are very concerned about the financial status of our county partners, and all but two counties have signed our 2009 Memorandum of Understanding. In general, the funding for the last 3 years at the county level, our increase in county funding has increased anywhere from 4% to 7% on an annual basis. For 2009, it is flat, but in some areas it has increased, especially in 4-H. So we are working directly with our county partners, the Association of Minnesota Counties, to make sure that we're meeting those local needs. And every county that I've had conversations with about that may decrease their level of funding for extension, that they are doing that because of financial reasons, not because they're not happy with the program. So extension remains at the county level a non-mandated funding, and so that is one that we're going to have to work with. But as you will hear me discuss and you talking to our faculty and staff, that we have a commitment to have a local, regional, and statewide presence for extension, and that we will continue to do what we can to make sure that we have that. And working with counties that may have to decrease their commitment and being very clear with them what that means and what our responsibility is from the statewide system to the local system. So if you would like more specifics, I can give those to you, but you know, again, just to let you know that we have that statewide commitment to extension.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair. To Dean Durgan, I was a former 4-H'er, and I think it's a wonderful program. When I was in it, I think it was near the, as far as the membership, it was at the peak. And since then, it's declined in the Wabasha County area. And I'm just wondering, outside of southeastern Minnesota, just statewide, what is the trend of the 4-H program? Are you growing in numbers, declining in numbers? I know I've also heard that you're really going outside of the public dollars for the private dollar to support the 4-H program. Can you just kind of give me an idea of where the 4-H program is headed? Because it's definitely a program that I want to see preserved throughout Minnesota.
Our 4-H program in the last 3 years in Minnesota is growing in the number of our clubs. We have over 34,000 members and clubs right now. One of our biggest growth in our 4-H and youth programs are programs that are built on the 4-H club model, but they are after-school programs. We have over 250,000 youth involved in after-school programs, both in the urban and the rural areas. So using those principles of 4-H clubs, but going to where the students are in after-school programs. Our commitment is, and our goal in 4-H is to increase the number of youth in clubs. We feel that's the best way to reach these youth. As being a former 4-H member, you know that having that long-term commitment to youth is the best way to make them leaders that they are today. So we're committed to doing that. We also are working very hard to increase our funding from non-state and federal sources. We have our Minnesota 4-H Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization that raises money for 4-H. We were number one in the nation last year in raising funds. We raised 13% of all the funds nationwide that was raised for 4-H. So we are being very aggressive in looking for outside funding. Some of our major funding is with McKnight. We have just now received a large grant for 3M to work on alternative energy through our STEP program, Science, Engineering, and Technology. So we're very excited about working in some of these new areas of building the next scientist, you know, where our next scientist is coming from, and some of our foundations like 3M and McKnight are very excited about funding those programs. So those are programs within our 4-H programs and our after school programs. So we're working on that. You know, one of our issues continues to be is that we need to have that local county commitment so that we have that local 4-H educator in that county to be able to build those clubs. Without that, that's going to be a difficult thing for us to maintain.
If I could follow up one more question on 4-H, and my daughter was in 4-H too until just recently. She's in college now. But what are you doing to reach out to our minority population in 4-H? When we talk about new leaders, my Latino and Somali population in my community are kind of intimately involved with agriculture in many ways. I know the Hmong community down here, tremendous involvement. You go to the farmer's market, it's mainly... A good share of those folks are Hmong growers doing small plot work. What are we doing to establish clubs and recruit those folks? Because I do see them as some of our future ag leaders in this state, too. And they are a growing population and a base for recruitment of those types of professions.
Mr. Chair, we have a center for urban 4-H, and that center has focused on reaching out to the underserved minority populations in the urban area. So we have educators that are fluent in Spanish, also Somali and Hmong. And we're taking that model that we've learned in the urban areas now to outstate. So we have a number of our 4-H educators working with these minority populations to developing clubs. We've had the most success in after-school programs to reaching these audiences first. We have, in the last 3 years, an extension has funded 4-H interns, and many of those interns come from those communities to work directly with those communities. So we know that those communities are outside the urban area. We've been successful in reaching many of those populations within the urban area, and now reaching out more to the rural area. So clubs, the 4-H club model, we found doesn't work as well with some of these minority populations just because of you know, the issues of culture and also family. But these after-school programs seem to be a very good way to reach these youth, and we are making a commitment to them, too.
Okay. We'll be interested in keeping an eye on that. Representative Tremba.
Mr. Chair, I actually still am a 4-H leader, so...
And thank you.
For the record. Anyone else? Well, we do appreciate you coming in and updating us. I think you hit most of the pieces in last year's Ag Special, and certainly if you didn't, we'll be asking you or your Mr. Iverson over there or others to get back to us on any questions we may have. I continue to say on a personal level, I do think that there is a big attitude and directional shift over there since Dr. Levine and Durgan, you've been there, and I appreciate that. I didn't know what was freer before or after you, Dr. Ames, but I'm sure it's good stuff since you've been there, too. And, you know, it's important. I will point to one other thing. I think... the 14 grad students were excellent, and we need to continue on that grad student. That's a huge concern in the state, continues to be, and I'm sure we'll probably be addressing that as we move forward. Members, next week, Tuesday, is Dairy Day here. We hear everything about dairy from one end to the other. And on Wednesday, we will continue this discussion on research going on in the state and needs for research in the state as we progress to putting this bill together. With that, meeting's adjourned.